You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this evening's Lyric Feature, the second of two programmes for Seachtain na Gaeilge, in which bilingual Irish writers discuss their work and their dual linguistic heritage. This evening, it's the turn of the poet Louis de Puer, who was born in Cork but has not lived there for many years. In this programme, he goes back to explore the Cork of his childhood, where he first learned Irish, and an even older Cork, the Cork that his father knew, which runs throughout his poetry. This is The Shaky Bridge.
Cligini. Tan vaidin ho socor rigonamara, guglosham cligin onifig gebuola, e glosam togali, la vila on dig. An vashtuch ho heatrum, gomraham giranail maher, is e smita blocken aimwit erhul and tea e gorkig. Nor glayan mavam on gishtin, arienche a vaher fein, or all in aher, tachtestach on yin air, saravuroche. Tashe demli in a dish, is a aher ho gairedo len a chrekin fein. An vaidin ho soccer, go glushin che cligi nifige in eigene vic, blienta fado valle, or allish, gulagohin dientige go foil, tachtestach anish, saravuroche. Bells. This morning is so quiet in Connemara, I can hear the office bell ringing in the builder's yard half a mile from here. The rain, so light, I feel my father's heavy breath as he chops wooden blocks behind the house in Cork. When my mother calls out from the kitchen, he hears his own mother telling his father to come in for his dinner before it gets cold. He's 10 years old, and his father is as close to him as his own skin. The morning, so still, he hears an office bell in his son's head, years away from home, telling him he's done enough for now to come in before he goes cold.
My name is Louis de Puer. I'm an Irish language poet from Cork City. I haven't lived in Cork for about 40 years, but I have noticed that the poems keep coming back to Cork. And it really was only in the course of working on this programme that it occurred to me that the Cork that the poems keep coming back to is not really my place. It's my father's city, the city he and his father, from whom I'm named, grew up. So one of the nice things about doing this on radio is that you can't actually see what we're looking at, and you don't need to, because the place we're going to know is in my head and in the poems. And we're in Merchant's Quay, which is where my grandmother's family had a ship's chandlers. They specialised in oilcloths. And I'm joined by historian Diarmaid O'Driscoll, who knows far more about all of this than me. So, Diarmaid, can you just tell us a little bit about this part of Cork and what it might have been like to be grown up in a place like this, where the ships came up? Ships connecting to everywhere in the world came up right into the heart of the city.
There are no ships here today because the bridge downriver from Merchant's Quay has sealed off access to this area for larger vessels. But in my childhood and your childhood, right up until the late 70s, in fact, boats could come right up here as far as Patrick's Bridge and tie up. That's what it was. It was shipping, dockers, chandling, fitting out ships, working on ships, drinking by sailors from ships, drinking by dockers who loaded ships. That was part and parcel of here. And you mentioned your grandmother's shop, because Merchant's Quay that we're looking at, it started at the corner behind us, Queen's Hotel, and ran along here. There were maybe 20 or 30 different premises, quite a number of pubs, number of chandlers, ship suppliers of various kinds, and of course the famous Crowley's music shop was on this quay as well. And opposite you had lots of stores and mills and all of that sort of stuff.
In my time, coming to visit here on Merchant's Quay, we used to go in and visit my auntie Nell, who ran what was really a kind of a sweet shop, but going into it was like going to something in Charles Dickens. It felt like the 19th century. The apples were wrapped up in like glass cases, and sweets were, you know, behind
in jars for weighing out and that.
Yeah, all of that was there. But my father told a story then that when Auntie Nell had the place, they used to sell broadsheets of ballads that were very popular at the time, and occasionally they put them in the window on display. But that they'd stopped doing that because a young fella would be sent down who could read, and he'd learn it off by heart, and then he'd go away, and nobody had to buy them. the broadsheet. I'm just wondering about that kind of culture, like the crossover into literacy. When does that happen for people, the whole notion of broadsheet ballads and politics?
Cork in the first two decades of the 20th century, you had running riots in the streets, the Mollies and the All for Irelands and all the rest of them. Like, they took their politics really seriously, and kind of monster meetings were held, the old city hall, you know, and the place would be packed to the doors. So people were certainly far more involved in their politics then than they are now. In terms of literacy and that, I suppose, well, that began to develop really, I suppose, from the middle of the 19th century with the growth of the primary schools and that. And of course, then the work of people like the Presentation Sisters here, educating the poor girls, the Northman, the Brother. So a lot of people, like, there was a good level of literacy.
So my granny, she'd have been Elizabeth Meehan, born in 1900 in Anderson's Quay. She then went to the model school. What sort of place would the model school have been in the first decade of the 20th century?
Well, the model schools were built in the 1850s, and the idea was to, as the name suggests, to be a model for how schools should be and how education should be run. But it was unusual in that it wasn't controlled by a parish. The model schools were owned, I think, by the Office of Public Works, so the local clergy didn't have control.
Would there have been independent-minded people that might send their children
there? Yes, I would think so, very much so. And they would have, it would have been hugely cross-sectional. And certainly in the 20th century, like, you had an awful lot of Jewish kids coming from what was called Jewtown down by Albert Road in Cork. You would have had, I suppose, non-conformists of various kinds as well, and then people who'd be devoted to the Irish language.
And people with notions, maybe?
Possibly. Everybody has a notion of some kind, don't forget.
When I was looking at the census records, my granny is recorded as being able to read and write Irish. Yeah. My father thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard in his whole life, because she hadn't a word. So I'm presuming you would have been declaring your separatist tendencies by putting your children down because they were attending school as able to read or write Irish. Yeah. So we're here now, Dermot, off French's Quay, and it just dawned on me, I have two or three poems set around here. I have one poem about the Golden Angel on the top of St. Finbar's Cathedral. I have another about the killing of a very young girl when I was a child that had everybody terrified in the school and beyond the school. This is a very rich part of Cork in terms of history.
It really is. We're on Kaiser's Hill, and the name Kaiser is said to come from Scandinavian language, from when this was a Norse settlement back in the 11th century. Behind us, Elizabeth Fort is there from the early 17th century, and beyond that again is where the original Cork Monastery would have been. And looking across from where we are now, looking across Southgate Bridge into the South Main Street area, they are the original marshes on which the city was built.
I remember hearing an interview that David Hanley did with Sidney Nolan one time, and he talked about his own family coming from Clare and growing up in Australia. He knew that they were tough people, and Hanley asked him, what else do you know? And he says, well, I always knew the Cork people were soft. So in the poem Corkach, there's a kind of a marshiness inside the people as well as a marshiness in the surrounding place itself. But the poem is set at a time of huge emigration. It's the world, I suppose. I came of age in the 1970s and 80s, and it's at a time I was about to come back on a visit from Australia, and I was going to go, and I thought I was going forever and wouldn't ever be coming back.
The 80s was a sad time in Cork. It really was a depressing time. Businesses closed, small businesses, shops. The English market burnt down 1980, 81 as well. So many people left, so many people that you'd have grown up with, you yourself, and people I grew up with as well, had to leave.
Corkach. Bhí sé fuair fliuch ar French's Quay is mé tríal arís an maile. An chart na seasamh chodlú leis a gosán le bord sahig builte le calla. Seana bhain stracathe ón monarchan dúnta a scríbe fallan na cé san áit in ar tháinig na Francaigh i dír. I gathar na gúan is an áing a titim an spéir, bhí fáine tarhála scórtha dá chuile, trasna na sráide ó hach na sochrida. Bhí scog fhí bí an vardas á dachta ag famuin vrúsgair a vrúcht an ís a trofé hír, is madarí baite á dúrt chun siúil i málí gúil ar farig amach i dró an fosáiste hír. Bhí cúl na carta chó clóthar le kistan. Back of the car was warm as a kitchen, watertight as a fish's arse, until a single swollen drop fell on the windscreen, trickled through a crack in the reinforced glass and along the bridge of our captain's nose, where he sat unmoved in the front seat. When the riverbanks broke behind my father's eyes, tin buckets couldn't bail me out as tears gushed through the eye of a needle and Jesus wept over my submerged head. Church spires and railway lines crumpled, millstones and hearts like stone were broken, walls and flagstones buckled as the earth moved and the asthmatic bog filled my lungs again. I couldn't wait to get away from the soft, soft earth that had made me before the last tear was squeezed from the stone in my heart, before love wrapped itself round my neck, dragging me, drowning, home. So Fitzgerald's Park, which is where we are now, is the main park in Cork City. And just on the other side of that, you have Daly's Bridge. It's a suspension bridge, which is referred to by most people in Cork as the Shaky Bridge. And it's a kind of iconic, shared memory of childhood for most of us, that older members of the family would bring you onto the Shaky Bridge. They'd jump up and down it, so you'd be in fear of your life that the bridge was going to fall. But the poet Liam O'Meara, who's associated with the Inti group of poets that emerged in UCC in the late 60s and early 70s, Liam has a very powerful poem about Oireachtain in which he uses the image of the Shaky Bridge to indicate what Oireachtain's poetry does, that it straddles the Irish language and the English language. In a sense, it provides a shaky bridge for us between Irish and English. But it's also somehow indicative of Cork City itself, between two arms of the river. And I suppose, as we're discovering, between alternative histories. I'm going to go across now to UCC to meet Liam's sister, Claire Ní Mhíreála, and we're going to go to look at some books from Sean O'Riordan's library. O'Riordan is the outstanding modernist poet in the Irish language, and he had a long association with University College Cork. This is very weird, Claire, to be speaking to you in English. I don't know if we've ever had a full conversation that wasn't in Irish, but for people listening to this, it might seem that it's actually strange that you and I should be more comfortable in Irish. We both grew up in suburbs of Cork at more or less the same time, in English-speaking families, in English-speaking areas. So how did you end up having Irish at the centre of your life, the way it is?
It is very strange. I kind of get used to it after a while, Louis, talking to you, us Berla. I come from a family of nine, and I was number eight. So my memories are very different to my peers or my older siblings, and the influences are different. My three brothers, Liam, Seamus and Finbar, went to Colossus de Creus III, and it was a very good school, and Irish was very strong there, and they had fantastic Irish, and they had great teachers. My sisters as well. I think all the family liked Irish. Liam, my older brother, was 8 years older than me. And so when I was a baby, he was eight. You know, when I was eight, he was 16. Those differences were huge. And I'm just talking about Liam because of the influence he had on me regarding the Irish language. Then my memory is of Liam getting a scholarship to the Gaeltacht. That was probably when he was in UCC. So Liam went on a scholarship to the Gaeltacht, And my father had to bring him down because there was no other way of getting down to West Kerry at the time. So I remember Daddy driving and I went with him. I suppose I was 11 and I fell in love with the place myself. I still love it. I still love Corcachina and the people. But that's my first, I suppose, connection with the Gaeltacht.
So what about your parents then? They were not Irish-speaking, were they?
No.
What was the attitude, or was there anything positive or negative in the family attitude to the language?
Oh, very positive, always. My parents were very open to education. Daddy would have been the tougher person regarding us going to school. My mother was more flexible, I suppose, but she did love Irish, and she loved music, and she used to sing, and she'd sing songs in Irish as well. So that was a big influence on all of us. My mother's brother, Uncle Taiga Morahu, he was a fluent Irish speaker, and my mother's father had a brother who was a priest, who was a brother, and he was very interested in Irish.
So there are very interesting parallels there for me. I'm the eldest of nine, but Diarmuid Ó Scaoil was saying the same thing as you're saying, and I would say that ultimately for me it was in school was where I was exposed to Irish.
Mm.
I felt coming out of the education system, out of primary school particularly, that I had two languages, and it never seemed to me either a necessarily brilliant thing or a necessarily terrible thing, but that I was entitled to have both. And then you discover that other people think you're odd.
I don't know. I never kind of thought of it like that, being honest. I suppose I'm very grateful to that influence, to the exposure to the language, and I'm very grateful for the welcome in Dún Chuain especially.
Liam, has this phrase, I think it's in Bruach na Lí, initially, Alagar na Sinsir, so like it's the, I translated it somewhere as the murmur of the ancestors, and in your family, that there were people from the country and from the city, and when you lived in Douglas Street at the centre of the city with the slaughterhouses around and the rest of it, that there was this sense that the country came into the city here, and that somehow Irish bridged that. Would your sense of your own family be a bit like Liam's in that?
I had no idea of Douglas Street because I was only a toddler when we left. Only until later years, actually reading Liam's works, a lot of it, his poems.
My experience is close to what you just said there now, that memories that you've acquired through Liam's writings are very real, living things for you. Again, looking back over my own poems, I've realised that many of the poems are about Cork City. They're not about my Cork City. They're about my father's Cork and my grandfather's Cork. And the older I get, the closer 1900 seems to me, the more interested I am in the man I'm named after. The world of Cork from 1900 to the 1920s feels like part of me, even though I didn't live it. So maybe in a way that's what we're doing in all of this as well, and that's why people write poems for themselves first of all and then for others, so that you inherit memories.
What came into my mind there, Louis, was Máchan Rudaí, and when I hear Iarla Ollinard singing it, it is, I think it's one of the most powerful works Liam ever did.
Mulvachan of the Vakling Sifik Georgine Bert of Fitzgerald's Park Smishanisha Tree Ar mach yn yr ein ar gofach yn mach yn dyhat yn lwys er dy gori. Mae fach yn ystw dy mwn per yr ffag ne mi mach yn sigwys ligwys airi. Dy fach yn ffyn ar ardys rhyf o halaf ach yn twch yr ydalaf dy fach yn byw.
Like everything in that poem is so powerful, and not just for me remembering my mother, but it really gives a picture of her life and of our lives and of the country connection. And a line that jumps out at me there is the footsteps, the heavy footsteps of the country people coming up the stairs, and that was my Auntie Mary, my mother's sister. And I remember that so clearly. And all those memories, even though I wasn't in Liam's life for all of his life, but his memories, as you say, they're maybe they're becoming a part of mine, but I can really connect into what he's saying in that poem, of all the poems, I suppose. But I think you can too. I think everyone can too, because I think it could be anybody's mother.
I have a poem about my own mother called An Croitheoir, and it's about being in bed upstairs, half awake, listening to her clearing out the ashes downstairs and starting to put the breakfast together, and realising that actually she's creating the world that I'm going to come downstairs and into. And maybe that's true for all of us, that it's the mothers ultimately create the world as well as creating us, I suppose. An Croitheoir. Sar airig an áhhaidin in ís as scibáil doracha hís ar bhóthair na mó airme, bhí gob éin a fógart an lé, ag cnaga ar scragal chapín budéal vanya ar lic an dora seomó. Sar ghúsig an tig as a chuan réamh rethe, bhí an domhan chuí féin aici, domhan deabhhuainte nár láir ina cuine, a dhéal go réig dúd rás cuin a láh. In Arda Steira, I limbo na bilúr is na blid, vi kertucha kola mar ivech olan chadáis trá tinnis in a chluis. Darise báur glóir na sluis de bigge, is skriaba ur lár an gráta, e karta lua an leich ui gas samachas a dig, agus lá úr a chur sísike na chóir. Chula sé gaes statica, a shéide o chion cion na Atlantica, ag omra ver haunt an air ed a Reykjavik us a luin, graimsig si an vinnikiacht chrín, a chur corkig a gertlar an teal, ag kaint leo sísil sa chishtan, sé trehe la stís da hairav. The Creator. Before the morning rose from a dark shed below on the model farm road, a bird's beak announced the day, pecking the tin-filed top of a milk bottle out on the doorstep. Before the house woke from its prenatal sleep, she had the world to herself, a well-mannered world that didn't answer back, giving in quietly to the gentle authority of her hands. Up the stairs, in limbo, land of pillows and blankets, rags of sleep bandaged his brain like cotton wool in an aching ear. He heard the muffled sound of the small shovel scraping stone as she cleared the ashes of the day gone out and set another day kindling in the cold grate. He heard gusts of static pitched from one end of the Atlantic to the other, churning the airwaves between Reykjavik and Athlone until she found the right frequency that put Cork at the centre of the world, talking to her quietly in the kitchen, 6 feet under his dream. On the table in front of us here, I'm going to mispronounce these now, but there's three Spanish poets who include Rosalia de Castro, whom Liam translated towards the end of his life, Lorca, of course, and Antonio Machado, who clearly was a favourite of Aoirre Daoin's, because there are several volumes of his here. And I know also that when Carúl O'Dálaigh, as president of Ireland, visited Aoirre Daoin when he was dying, what he presented him with was the complete poems of Machado. It's kind of eye-opening and mind-blowing for us, isn't it, to discover that Aoirre Daoin was immersed in this stuff. I only stumbled upon this in the last little while. Liam discovered it much earlier.
Well, I don't remember Liam having any interest in Spanish when I was young, until recent years. And then when, of course, he wrote the poem, the poetry book, El Camino de Santiago, you know, it's a simple book, people say, but to me, it's the most precious. But so I'm kind of delighted and amazed at this connection.
But it's interesting also, isn't it, that the poets we're talking about, they're not just bilingual, but they're comfortably trilingual. So it's not just that Aoirre Daoin and Liam have created a shaky bridge that allows us to bring Irish and English together, but also there's a bridge into the greater world outside of Ireland. I was thinking actually again just this morning about that idea of the shaky bridge, and I was thinking, does it really hold up? And then I thought, actually, that is exactly how I think my own Irish is. It's definitely not the Irish of the Gaeltacht, even though the West Kerry Gaeltacht had a significant influence on my use of Irish. But
It's a shaky bridge, which means you're never quite sure. Will it hold up? You feel like it's, you know, it's quaking under you and you're not quite sure, and all you need is somebody to stamp behind you and tell you, you made a mistake there, that's wrong, and it'll collapse under you. But we keep walking across it and it keeps holding us up. Seliuktusa idir gha ling aliam. Graim and of ruachagut no man's long a heritu le fwill agus allas de fien. Graimshig the staich of fain se gaul idir gha na haun. Drihid guagach dienta docil gar federling a hiul anish id a haunta. You were born between two rivers and two stories, Liam, gripping the banks of that no man's land of language. You worked with the blood and sweat of your pen till you found your place in the fork between two arms of the river, a shaky bridge made of words. We can now walk beside you. So we're walking up now from Western Road, just a little bit further out. What's the dog track? It's not there anymore, dear.
It's gone. No, it's UCC buildings.
My father always claimed that was the limits of the known world and the civilised world. But we're just coming past 4 Sunnyside. That's where my granny and granddad live, and my father, yeah. His two brothers and his sister grew up. So we've come from Western Road up Sunnyside, where my granny and granddad's house was and where my father grew up. He grew up there in the 1930s and 40s, born in 1928. And later in his life, he told stories just about the extent to which, I suppose, what he would have seen out the window in the jail, because the jail was still here at that time. Clearly, there had been crowds outside. He told us about crowds gathering outside and being dispersed with some violence by guards whose names they knew, and he'd point them out to you. But what kind of things would the prisoners be doing?
39 of them escaped one night by getting down through a shaft, and they came up through a manhole on the road there and dispersed. So the prisoners were agitating, going on strike. They weren't going back to their cells. They were getting rifle butts in the head and so on, and being pushed around, and shots were fired, and a guy called Mangan was shot and died. And that really created a bitter atmosphere within the prison, within the jail, and then, of course, in the wider community outside here. Because that was September 22. It was only a month before that Cork fell to the Free State Army. So your dad, as a young fella, he mightn't exactly remember that, but he had certainly heard about it from his parents and his neighbours and so on, because that's what they would have been living with here.
So one of my father's stories about growing up here in the shadow of Jail Cross was that there was a man killed. He added that the man was killed coming out of the jail, but that might not be correct if we look at the plaque that's here behind me. But his story was that on the day of the killing, he was up behind a famous bar in Cork called the Western Star, and there was an orchard there, and he and other boys from along here were stealing apples there, and they heard the shots, and because they were kids, he said, they all started running only a few hundred yards away towards where the shots were being fired, at the same time that all the mothers came out of Sunnyside here and were shouting their children's names to come home away from the gunfire. So the plaque here says, in almost the Hiano Quavanig Ogloch Complach Do Kahalan Brigade Hain Corkig Oglignahern, fatally shot by Free State Special Branchmen whilst engaged unarmed in making a tunnel to rescue Republicans prisoners from Cork Jail. And Triula Lunasa, Nadiag Dahad, Yesh De Goreva Anam. And that brings us to the poem Jail Cross. Jail Cross. His Sunday best was freshly pressed, his heart shut tight, and a double knot on the twine that kept his cardboard suitcase together, so the ties that kept him bound for England could not be undone. When the rough twine chafed his hand, the eyes in the back of his head saw Tomás Óg McCurtain march in front of the house, head and shoulders above his Garda escort, as the great coat of the Free State hid the handcuffs that chained him to the future. He heard again from the walls of the old jail gunshots as sudden as a flurry of windfalls. That day he was out robbing apples in the orchard behind the Western Star. A man was shot in the river field on the run from his place in the history books. He heard the shouts of all the mothers on the street that day, loud as a clatter of bin lids, calling the boy troop home, his own name sworn like an oath for all the world to hear.
We've moved now to a glass house in the grounds of Hayfield Manor, just on the outskirts of Cork City, and I'm joined by Donal Gallagher. And before we talk about Rory, Donal, I'm also interested in your own family story. And one of the threads linking all the people we're talking to here is about it has to do with the Irish language and our individual relationship with it. So if I understand correctly, Donal, your mother was born in Cork, but her immediate forebears are native speakers, at least on one side, from Coolay.
Correct. And she was very gifted with the language, and my grandmother also had a great grasp of it. And my mother's younger brother, Jim Roach, who became principal of the RTC and founded that, he was absolutely gifted. And they had a lovely gloss in the language.
And then your mother presumably made, or your mother and father made, the decision to send you to the model school, which was an unusual school because Irish was the medium of instruction there long before the explosion of Gaelscoileann and the rest of it. It would have been quite a unique place.
My father was a dairyman who had crossed over the border and joined the Free State Army and got transferred down to Cork eventually, and that's where he met my mother. So he didn't have any Gaelic. We were always seemed to be in a train up and down to Derry, across to England, because my father, after the war, couldn't get work in Derry. And obviously he'd nailed his colours to a mast, and it became uncomfortable to the point that the marriage just petered out eventually. So we were put into school in Cork, and the model school was regarded as one of the best. And there, you know, it seemed very easy to pick up the language. And Rory and I were quite good. But then that all came to a stop because we were taken back up to Derry. After a number of years, my mother said, no, Cork is where we need to come back to. So when we came back down to Cork, we were introduced into the North Monastery. And then I remember they were streaming us into the classrooms. And this was in front of the whole, seemed to be the whole school. Rory was fine. He got put into his correct year. And then I remember the head brother in front of the school, you kind of made a little bit of an example of it, said, now we're going to ask this boy to see which class he can fit in to recite the second part of the Shade of Ahawira. The what? Shade of Ahawira. And I was just dumbfounded. And then I remember the head brother saying to the school, you see, this is what's happened in the North of Ireland. They can't practice their language. And this boy can't speak Gaelic, so he's going to have to go down a year.
And was that the secondary school at that stage?
No, that was primary. That was primary.
And it was Irish-speaking?
Yeah, wow. So that was...
what a terrible misuse of
fifth class down
language.
To fourth, or fourth down to third. But, yeah, but, well, I suppose it served as a lesson to... I mean, there was always that, the threat of the leather or the threat of something else.
And did you continue to secondary school in the Mon then?
Yeah. I went through to intersect level. Rory was en route to do his leaving because he was actually a very bright student. He was very good, and he just didn't seem to have difficulty with homework the way I had. I recently located Rory's poetry book from when he was doing his leaving cert.
Wow.
So these were the poems that he would have been doing, and amongst which obviously he's doodling and making his comments.
So it's Leaving Poetry, 1964-65. Rory Gallagher, is that 24 or 27, McCurdy?
27.
And then he's obviously, like we all did, I mean, he had more reason to do it, practising his signature to versions of it. So we have Shakespeare, Milton, Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats, Dryden, Browning, Samuel Ferguson, Páraic Chulainn, William Butler Yeats. That's it from the Irish side of things. Whoa. I'd need my glasses now to have a look at that. Adverbial clauses. It's grammar. Adjectival clauses. Noun clauses. That's fantastic. Monday, they did prose. Tuesday was Macbeth. Friday, poetry. God, that's marvellous, isn't it? He was, as you said, studious.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And as a songwriter, I mean, he was quite studious about getting his facts and practicing the craft of, as others had done it.
He's a very crafty writer of lyrics. I mean, the actual craft and the skill required to turn those lyrics in a particular way, like there's something a bit fairly free-form about something like A Million Miles Away, but Tattooed Lady, for all that it's the guitar solos that everybody remembers, right, that's an amazing lyric. It's a dream-like poem, running away with the circus.
Well, that, actually, we're just a short distance from what it was, the Mardyke. In those days, just beyond Fitzgerald's Park, you had a clearing that the funfairs used to come to. And that was Rory's heaven. So that's where he pushed the penny, if you had any, made you down by the shooting gallery and the Tattooed Lady, or the freak shows, etc.
Ye moved into your grandmother's pub. Did ye have more freedom, do you think, in your mid-teenage years than other people growing up in a pub? Both of you seemed to be involved in a music scene when you were 15, 16, or even earlier, and there seemed to be a huge amount happening in beat clubs and the rest of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, Rory was straight out of the traps. I remember when the decision was made to move back to Cork from Derry, Rory being the older brother had a far better concept of it. And that was his bargaining chip. I'll go to Cork as long as I can get a proper guitar. Rory was then taken over to Crowley's, which was then in Merchant's Quay, and he got a very beautiful little basic acoustic guitar, and he set about learning that. It was his prized possession.
In Cork in the 1970s, the two big heroes for us were Jimmy Barry Murphy and Rory Gallagher, and Rory really showed that being from Cork was no excuse for not being the best in the world at something. That's was our sense of it. I remember in the classroom when people heard that he hadn't joined the Rolling Stones, it was like, yes, like, too good. I mean, we'd lose him and he'd only get little bits here and the rest of it. So every single year, like, from his previous visit, nearly always at Christmas, you'd be thinking, will he come back next year? And the excitement of it. And it's never left me, the excitement of that very first concert. I've never seen anybody as good with an audience, so that you felt for as long as he was on stage, this is the most important place in the world for the next hour and a half. Himpan mavas, an chrictim chisla minu amach, idar tordog is minihing vuilte, gan notim chiaun nach an spinne churishe, le strongana an achran. Baitlum, greifa tin cairacht mar sin ner vile skair an tuin, is tormán ar mas vuile a liana fe hala da lav, a hof snav smegin dam vien a troch der ishke kwebe. An ein ar
trí an tuile a líonort. Ráir do cos is sláb a dhéon bord linge don ór lár a hala na carach. Ná líonig festa an póil a dágas ar ardán i dhéag. Ar nghile bhar loimnach mair is solas na vlachas a slúistú cúnis ar chúil an tlua a tá búilte le stáidse ag gléach ar eisar don nirachacht Rory, Rory, Rory. An glasim tú anis ar ngai
Gaelic growing up to us was a kind of a love-hate relationship because you couldn't really sing rock and roll in Gaelic. It didn't work. Rory and I, what we used to employ the language for is when we'd be in company of people that we didn't particularly want to know what we were saying. Rory and I would speak in Gaelic. And particularly, obviously we're brothers, but the relationship as manager and the artist, if there was some kind of a negotiation or whatever, we'd drop into Gaelic and talk in Gaelic. That was a lovely way to practice your language. And Rory, probably as dare I say, his last words were in Gaelic. When he was in the hospital, and this was following the transplant, at one point then they had to perform a tracheotomy, and I was asked to sign off on the tracheotomy, and I thought, well, this is a bit too far for me, because what of his vocal cords, but you know, anything to save his life at that time, because the bug had possibly set in by then, but anyway, it cleared the lungs. It was the only way to do it. And he actually came great. I remember he got capped off. He was so healthy, he got capped off. And so I could talk to him. And I remember calling my mother and saying, he's fine, he's doing well, he's capped off. He can now speak a little bit. So I'm going to put you on the phone. She was thrilled to bits about it, you know. And he went, Avaher, avaher, nemi, nilmi, abelta, kaintinish. And went on a few more words. I can't remember exactly, but just to say, I'll speak to you in a few days, because there were other people in the room. He was such a private person. And frankly, they're the last actual physical words.
The Cork to which the poems find their way home then is as much my father's place and time as it's mine. Irish too, which his grandparents claimed for their children before they knew it, he claimed for his children, signing his name in Irish on notes he sent to our school, nudging us towards a second language that has become my first working language, the everyday language of poems and imagination. My father is still here in a poem written after the birth of his first great-grandchild, years before he died. Schlíne fíringe. Táim shíri in a láhir. Chó críane le bradán as a ró. Nís óigin a vís e maher óg is a maher siúd in bakling. Trí hachtan sar of bertahe de tacht it a sach vín a marav. Hereafter. I'm deathless in her presence, old as the salmon of Asaroe, younger than I was as a young father holding her mother 3 weeks before she was due in the beginning of the month of the dead. Time has been out of kilter ever since, and I'm so old and innocent tonight, I shouldn't be left cross the road on my own in the dark. All the colours the earth has gathered from the sky are sifted through the eyes of a child who can't decide which one suits her best in the light that stretches from her triangular toes to my father's grey eyes as he keeps his hand on my shoulder on the edge of the main road. The child stands between us, a lantern telling us there's no need to be afraid anymore. She won't leave here till she sees two shadows waving back from the other side she left behind just now, eternity gripped in her fist. Tanyanov Nishasav Adring, Lochranikin Araling, Nakga Eanagla Fasta, Niakashi Anaicha, Gavekashi Roskoi Libanude, Onait Howl Afregshi Erbowl.
The Shaky Bridge was presented by Louis de Puer. The English translations of his poems were by Kevin Anderson, Biddy Jenkinson, Mary O'Donoghue and Louis de Puer. Music in the programme was by The Gloaming, Micro Disney and Rory Gallagher, and the reading of the poem Rory was accompanied on guitar by Albert Nyland and it was mixed by Ronan Brown. Louis de Puer's poetry is published by Blood Axe Books and Clo Ir Chonokta. The Shaky Bridge was produced by Claire Cunningham with sound supervision by Tin Pot Productions. The programme was a Rock Fringe production for the Lyric feature and was supported by the RTE Independent Radio Productions Unit with funding from Cumasún na mBan from the television licence fee.
You're listening to the Lyric feature on RTE Lyric FM.
The series producer is Owen O'Kelly, and the production coordinator is Michael O'Kane.
You can listen to that programme on our website, or you can podcast it from the RTE radio app and other podcast platforms. You can contact the programme by email, features.lyricfm@rte.ie. On next week's Lyric feature, we begin a reprise of our 2024 series, Feather and Flock, in which Anya Murray and Brian McGlynn delve into the ways of six iconic native Irish birds. Each episode combines ecology, folklore and history to uncover the incredible lives and journeys of these wild creatures. Next week's episode features the cuckoo. And that's nearly all from us this evening on The Lyric Feature. John Kelly's Mystery Train is coming up at 7 o'clock. And to take us up to that, here's Linda Buckley's Revelavit, and it's played here by musicians from the Ergados Collective, and the singer is Michelle O'Rourke. Ergodos musicians and mezzo-soprano Michelle O'Rourke in Linda Buckley's Revelavit. John Kelly's Mystery Train is coming up at 7. And until we meet again, Lá Éile Pádraic, Sonadaíobh Go Léir.